Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 339.
This week on the podcast, we went to Nevada for the caucus and we're going to tell you all about it.
Plus, we've got what to expect in the contests coming up.
Welcome to our Nevada special.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yeah.
You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter, where we spent a lot of time in the last few days.
Yeah.
Because we just literally stepped out of the car from our trip to Nevada.
Yes, we did. We're doing good work on there, by the way, guys.
We
if I do say so myself.
Really are. I feel like we also learned a lot in the Iowa process, and we're able to apply that information to the Nevada process.
Yeah.
But if you have any information, I mean, if you want any information about not only what our trip looked like, but, you know, literally what the process of the caucuses was, what it felt like on the ground there. We have all of that on Twitter and Instagram. Yeah. It's all there for the taking.
Photographic evidence of everything.
That's right.
Yeah.
Including us gambling $5.
Yeah. We lost it, by the way.
Yeah,
it didn't,
obviously.
It didn't come back to us in any sort of way.
No. No. It was not one of our lucky trips to Nevada. In any case, before we dive into the caucus itself, let's talk briefly about the debate on Wednesday night, because that debate was a...
Everything.
And everything.
It was so good. Liz Warren just ruled the world. It was so good.
It literally started being good within 1 second of starting, too, because they had like 1 second where they tried a usual MSNBC dumb question or whatever, and then Liz Warren interjected into an exchange that was supposed to be between Sanders and Bloomberg.
Right.
And was just like, came for Bloomberg immediately.
Just a total evisceration.
Clapped in my house.
Yeah, by yourself.
Yeah, by myself. I mean, I had to.
Yeah,
and I spent a lot of that debate clapping in my house by myself, which is not something that I usually do.
I know, because she just was coming for scalps.
I mean,
she did not care who it was. You know, she's spent the last 2 months pretending like she's best friends with Amy Klobuchar for reasons that literally no one can understand.
Right. They're not friends anymore.
They are not friends anymore. And I don't think that there was no warning sign for Amy Klobuchar, because she was, I mean, looking over her shoulder, like, for the rest of the entire night, basically.
Well, and Liz actually defended her on a point that wasn't super fair, that Buttigieg was trying to make,
right,
obviously. And then, so early in the night, she had come and tried to play ball with being, you know, was trying to be friendly.
And minutes later, was calling her healthcare plan, said that it was a Post-it plan after she called Pete's a PowerPoint plan.
Exactly.
I mean, she came prepared.
She came prepared. She came for blood. She also, for the first time, came prepared with opinions on things. I feel one of the things it's like been very obvious that she, and we've said this before on the podcast, but that she's had some consultants. As soon as her campaign started to look like it was gaining front runner status, she hired some consultants, obviously, because she was taking consultant advice, and you could tell because she was terrible. And this was really, I think, her back was up against a wall for this debate. She was not going to, she was not polling well in Nevada. She was not polling well anywhere anymore. And leading into Super Tuesday, she needed money more than anything else. We learned after this debate, you know, she got a huge fundraising boost out of this debate.
Better performance in Nevada also would have helped. But the money certainly helps.
The money certainly helps. Well, and also, the part of the Nevada issue was that there was so much early voting that the Nevada contest was already kind of cooked before this debate. But also, she had taken out a loan in January. Like, she was really up against it. So she raised a huge amount of money, and that will go a long way towards at least getting her back in the game a little bit in some of these big Super Tuesday states, because that's really what, I mean, I think she maybe just to herself should have an obligation to stay in through Super Tuesday. And I know I think she should stay in forever. But I mean, I think that's where she finally has an opportunity to go into some states where people are going to be sort of where she has a kind of appeal that she doesn't have in like Nevada.
She's acting like she's doing that. I mean, she was in Washington yesterday, and it was because their ballots just went out for like
Because they do all mail-in ballots.
All mail-in ballots, but like that is not even on Super Tuesday. That's after.
Right.
So I mean, she is seems as though she's like doing the things that would like lead you to believe that she's playing the long game. Whether she will be able to fund herself through the long game, and whether she actually can collect any delegates is another. I mean, like I understand like continue to stay in as long as you can, but like also if you're staying in and you're getting 9%, you're not actually doing anything meaningful. I get sort of like the idea of like, okay, especially when it looks like there could very well be a contested convention, but like you also had no power at a contested convention with literally zero delegates, which is what she's going around with right now.
I don't think that's the sort of tension, at least. I think...
No, I don't think it is. Obviously, she would like to not be doing that. Yeah. But,
My only concern was that she, in being someone who is taking consultant advice, would also take consultant advice about when and is not important for her to drop out. And I mean, she's susceptible to it, though, obviously.
Clearly.
You know, she hasn't exercised good judgment with this advice in the past.
No.
So my only concern is just that she make those considerations independent of what sort of insider establishment consultants tell her. No, that's all I think. Yeah.
Yeah, stop listening to them until you decide yourself that you want to drop out and when you feel good and ready to.
Right. Well, and also where if it is a moment that is good for your strategy as a progressive candidate as opposed to your strategy as just like your general DNC mainline candidate, because that's not what she is. In any case, Pete was also in fine form at that debate. He
sure
lectured everybody about everything. He lectured Bernie Sanders about the meaning of leadership.
Right.
He lectured Amy Klobuchar because she had that gaffe about not remembering the president of Mexico. But his lecture was almost so condescending that
I
felt compelled to forgive her and also punch him in the face.
Right. Because Amy Klobuchar was even like, are you calling me dumb?
Yeah. She got shocked by the sort of...
He wouldn't leave
it
be.
Line of attack being so aggressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't leave it be. And
he was clearly in a way that felt like it was put on trying to fluster her.
Yes.
Which was why you were so angry, I think. Because it was just like, he kept interrupting her. Mm-hmm. He had a plan.
Yeah.
It was like, it was a douchey plan. Yeah. But he was like, I'm going to fuck her up over this, including if I have to just sort of like talk over her to like fluster her to allow her to not get her words out.
Well, get ready, you guys, for this Pete Buttigieg, because he is about to enter some hostile territory, and he's about to get kind of nasty.
Oh, yeah.
In a way that is hard to see.
And he's going to keep gaslighting you. We're going to get to that at the end of the podcast. But it seems as though, if the last 48 hours are any indication, he's basically just turning into Donald Trump and sort of, you know, up is down and left is right. And,
and we're smooth-talking Donald Trump, but a Donald Trump in the fake news sense, for sure. In any case, the showing, like we said, didn't really help Liz perform much in Nevada.
She overperformed her caucus results within the entrance polls of people who said that they decided in the last few days.
Right.
So it helped minimally, but she still didn't even win that group. That group went to Sanders, as every single solitary group did, except
you guys,
people over 65.
Nevada
we'll get to that in a little bit. But
there for Sanders.
So it did help her marginally, I guess, but like between the early voting and then also still not even winning the group of people who decided recently, it didn't help her as much as I think that she was hoping that it would. But,
well, it's tough in a caucus too, because unless you're a candidate that's way overperforming, it's hard to get a kind of meaningful bump in a sort of fourth place finish in a caucus, because you end up not being viable in a lot of the rooms.
Right, yeah.
In any case, so we got to Nevada on Thursday night, and on Friday we went to 3 campaign rallies ahead of the caucuses. The first one that we went to was a Warren rally. It was because we wanted to hear Julian Castro speak. We have said many times that she has the best surrogates, and so we wanted to make sure that we were doing our due diligence, keeping an eye on the surrogate situation.
Yep. Bruce and Bailey were also there.
Bruce and Bailey were there. We all waved.
Yes.
As we do to our old friends, Bruce and Bailey, who we've traveled the country with.
Yep.
Julian was great.
And we also thought, we were like, there were 3 events that night, and we were like, well, we might not get to all of them. We for sure wanted to get to the second one, and we'll tell you why in a second. But we also felt like, we were like, well, maybe she'll be doing something different, because she just had this sort of like breakout moment, like literally 48 hours prior to when she was walking on the stage here. And so we were like, let's see if she sort of is like going balls to the wall here, right? And so Castro introduced her, and she came out, and she literally started her exact same stump speech about teaching her Dolly's, you know, school when she was in second grade. And Lyle and I were like, let's get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Not because it's not a great speech.
But we've
and
seen
look,
it
100 times.
And
look, the people in Nevada probably have heard it less than we have, specifically, who have now heard at least the beginnings of it 4 times.
Right.
And so it was, we left. And it wasn't because we don't love Liz Warren.
Right.
It was just because we had to get to the TLC performance at the Tom Steyer event.
You guys.
With open bar.
On Thursday night, we were scrolling through events to go to. And we were, there was like, Biden was in town, and Buttigieg was in town, and they were holding events at the exact same time. So we had to make some hard choices about which events we wanted to go to. We knew we wanted to see Warren because we knew that we wanted to see how her campaign was sort of dealing with
the
influx
was
of
the
excitement.
Early. So we felt like we could go to hers and then still get at least one other place.
Exactly. And we'd never seen Julian Castro stump for her. So, we were interested in, and it was a little bit earlier than the others. And then in the 6:30-ish range, it was like, all hell broke loose. There were like 14 events that you could go to.
Right.
And we thought, okay, like, first of all, I've seen 2 Pete Buttigieg events in the last couple weeks.
Yeah.
So I was like, I've seen enough of that.
You don't want to go there again.
No. Joe Biden is holding events with 7 people in middle school gyms all over the country. And we were just like, we did that once and it was plenty. Yeah. And so we had gone to a Tom Steyer watch party in Iowa that was mostly just staff. We were
that's where we were supposed to find out the Iowa results.
Right. But instead we took a picture with Tom Steyer, ate his food, drank his drinks.
And then found out the Iowa results 72 hours later.
That's right. But so we thought, okay, well, we'll try to go to the Steyer event. And then we discover that the Steyer event is featuring TLC
and Iconopop.
And then, by the way, before we go, we also find out that TLC is not endorsing Tom Steyer.
They're just there.
They're just there.
That's what it's come to for them, which is sad.
It was.
But you could see it in their eyes.
You could see it in their eyes. It was. There was like one moment where there was a dance break because it was a rap.
It was the waterfalls.
It was the waterfalls rap.
Yeah.
And they were playing a track of Left Eye.
Yeah.
Rapping.
Yeah.
Which is already a tragic circumstance to find yourself in, to have your friend who's tragically passed away in like a bus accident.
Yeah.
Rap the voice of your friend rapping as you do a dance break.
Yeah.
And then it's only made sadder by the fact that you're at a paid Tom Steyer event.
Yeah.
And I just, like, I looked in Chili's eyes.
I know.
And I was just like, this is really...
You didn't look into her soul because it was the moment that it left her body.
It had left the building, yeah. It was incredibly tragic. They also oddly played Red Light Special.
And Creep,
which is...
if you're wondering the most out-of-body experience you can have at a political rally, it's walking into, like, a club space and hearing Red Light Special.
And
knowing that you're about to hear Tom Steyer.
It was just incredibly bizarre and uncomfortable in many ways. But his supporters seemed very pumped.
Very pumped.
When he finally spoke.
Not pumped enough come Saturday.
Not pumped enough to do something. But just pumped. Well, it was another issue, though, where I noticed, because I actually recognized a lot of his staffers.
Yeah.
So I think that a lot of the room in a Tom Steyer event is often staffers, and they have a lot of merch. They're one of the most merch-heavy campaigns out there, besides Buttigieg. Right.
And they are the merchiest.
And they feed you.
And they have open bar because they're billionaires.
Exactly.
So
it's a great. They're great events to go to. I highly recommend going to a Tom Steyer event.
We tried to go to his caucus results party on Saturday because we assumed that we were going to get lunch, but then the caucus ran so freaking long.
That's right.
His party also
was at 1 p.m. when the caucuses started at noon, and we were like, this is a little wishful thinking.
Because he wanted to get all of the partygoers out of the party before they knew what the results were.
Exactly. But so, in any case, that was the most bizarre event of
that
the cycle.
Wild.
We saw Steyer speak, and it was the first time we saw him give an extended speech, because in Iowa, we had only seen him give just, like, a brief thank you.
Right.
And then, also, like, the Yang Gang was there. Like, it was...
Oh, yeah.
It was a...
The Yang Gang still exists, guys.
The Yang Gang still exists.
They are out there.
They're wearing their math hats. They're going to Tom Steyer events or whatever events they feel like. They are voting in the Nevada caucuses as one... caucus site near us had a tragic Yang Gang member who
had to get down to their like fifth choice to be able to pick a viable group at the precinct that he was at.
That's right. That fifth choice being Bernie Sanders. And apparently like most of those top four had actually already dropped out of the race. So it was like a real tragic circumstance. But in any case, and then from the Steyer event, we skipped out on Iconopop because for some reason they were going after he spoke.
I know.
I was like, no one's going to stay for this. But so then we went to the Bernie rally and got there just in time to catch Bernie.
So good.
This was the most fired up I've ever seen him.
He knew what was going to happen on Saturday, at least to some degree.
Because if you're wondering,
he could see it on his face, and he could obviously was feeling it in his bones. I mean,
if you're wondering what Bernie Sanders in a good mood looks like, and listen, it looks very similar to Bernie Sanders in any mood. I'm not here to suggest that there's a wide variety of
moods. Yeah.
But it was kind of adorable.
It was. Oh, yeah.
He got a little gleeful at times.
He had some jokes.
Yeah, he came with jokes. He was doing a lot of gesticulating, but it was new gesticulating. It was like happy gesticulating. And this was also where he debuted the new talking point that everyone's got their panties in a twist about, which is the point about him taking on both the Republican and Democratic establishments.
That was a real applause line, if you're wondering.
So Brent looked at me with a nervous expression.
I was initially scandalized by it, and I feel like that has sort of like allowed me to sort of see what other people are seeing too, because right. I reacted at least initially in the same way, which is weird because like I'm the one who left. I got no allegiance to these assholes.
I know. I was going to say, it's so funny because Brent and I, after 2016, had a discussion about how we were going to handle our anger with the Democratic Party, and he left the party.
I said, fuck it.
And I stayed in the party and said, I'm just going to be a thorn in their side. And anytime anyone says, well, you're not a real Democrat, I'm going to be like, listen, Joker, I am right. most certainly a real Democrat.
Yeah.
But when Brent looked over to me, as he, with his scandalized face at the taking on the
right,
Democratic establishment
line. I couldn't get her attention because she was screaming.
That's right. So it got a huge applause, and a lot of that applause was from me. So I apparently didn't have the knee-jerk reaction that would have helped me understand why everyone's so scandalized.
But I sort of like have changed my feelings on that, only because I feel like upon thinking about it, it really does sort of like fit into his bigger narrative. And it doesn't mean that he's, and you're going to hear otherwise, at the debate on Tuesday
and from
night.
Everyone
and from anyone
with a mouth on and a Twitter account
exactly about why he's talking about burning down the Democratic Party. And he's not. What he's talking about, and this is sort of like what he's talking about always, because he talks about it, at least when he tweeted it, he also sort of like lumped them in with billionaires also. And this just sort of like goes to his sort of like core message of giving power back to the people. He's not trying to end the Democratic Party. He's trying to give voice to the members of the Democratic Party. That's what he's doing here. He's not threatening to burn it down. He's not equating the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. I mean, to a degree, he's equating the fact that both of those parties ignore their constituents, but he's not equating them in the sense that he thinks they stand for the same thing.
Right.
He's just basically talking about them as sort of like power players who have ignored the people that they supposedly represent. Right, and organizations.
The DNC, aside from being a party, is also, it's an organization that that is organized in a manner that is not necessarily that democratic.
But people all of a sudden now seem to be like having some sort of like weird allegiance to the Democratic Party. And it's like, as of when?
Well,
as of just him saying this? Like,
well,
cares about what the actual party
it's
does.
It's part of what I find frustrating about the Vote Blue No Matter Who hashtag going around now during the primary. It's one thing during the general election to attempt to be like, listen, you guys, it doesn't matter what happens, but Donald Trump is terrible and we all get that.
Sure.
It's another to try to force that conversation into the middle of a primary process because it is actually acceptable at this moment in the process for us to be making distinctions between which candidates we would support and which we wouldn't.
Yes, which form of blue we like.
Exactly. And it is also acceptable for us to say that there are some forms of I wouldn't call blue, but existing people.
Right, some forms of blue or red.
Right, that are red and therefore are not actually acceptable choices for us.
Right.
This is when we get to do that. But I think also like people are maybe missing the point because they've been looking, because everyone else's language is really different from Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to a Bernie Sanders rally, I was actually thinking about this because I've been to a million Bernie Sanders rallies.
Yeah.
And at this point, we have seen every major candidate at a rally. So I say this from a place of informedness and not just speculation. But the language he uses is intentional, and it is really about the fact that you are supposed to look at the people in the crowd with you and be like, we are a movement together.
Well, that's the thing that, and oh yeah, we talked about this after that, like immediately upon leaving that, like besides the fact that like we just felt like he was like very good, but if you are a person who sort of is only familiar with debate Bernie Sanders or some sort of interview Bernie Sanders or angry Bernie Sanders, which is certainly a big part of who he is, you don't sort of like get what everyone kind of like really lives and dies for, like about him, because, and you really, more so than any of the other rallies that I've been at for him, I could feel it at this one.
I had
a really super hopeful, like empathetic, loving, like coming together, like we can do this, like we can make America and our lives better. Like I have not felt that good about either a candidate or even just an election in a minute.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the idea is that he is deputizing all of us to sort of be the change in the cheesy way of saying it. And that is really different than what other candidates are offering. Because a lot of them are saying, okay, I will go and represent your views up here in the tower.
Right.
I will be your person up in the tower. And Bernie Sanders is sort of saying, you will have to be my people up in the tower with me. And if you aren't, hearing that message, that's fine. I mean, that's what, you know, I always say when people ask me, I'm like, listen, I grew up in a movement household. That language really speaks to me, but I also intrinsically understand what he means in a way that I don't think everyone does. But I do think that that is why he's so popular. I think enough people do understand that.
It's what Obama did.
Exactly. It's the yes we can. Right. Yeah. And it... The messaging is not around what he will do for us and how he will listen to us. The messaging is around what we will all do together. And I think if you are scratching your head wondering, like, what on earth the appeal of this angry, screaming old guy from Brooklyn is to everyone, I think you should need to ask yourself what the appeal is of standing in a crowd of 20,000 people that all want you to be okay. It's because I think that is really the distinction between, like, sort of his style of politics and even Liz. I mean, this is where I see the distinction between him and Liz to some extent as well, because Liz Warren is running a progressive campaign, but a traditional campaign for sure. She's getting up there and saying, I will do this stuff for you. I will be your person on the inside.
Right.
And Bernie Sanders is not promising that. And I think that that's why it's so threatening to the establishment. He is not promising to be anyone's man on the inside. He's not promising there will be an inside when he's done.
Yeah.
What he's saying.
She's also talking only about herself.
Right.
In a way. That sort of, I think, what she thinks is sort of like proving as to why she will be the best person for you. But I mean,
you never even heard Sanders talk about himself until this cycle, or his, you know, you never heard his personal story until this cycle. And when he started telling his personal story, it was in part because he was doing outreach to immigrant communities and communities of color. And he was saying, listen, I will be your man from the inside. It's more like I get what the problem is. Yeah. And we all get this together. So we're all part of the same thing. Whether or not you think that that's a plausible political strategy or too cheesy of a political strategy or not cheesy enough of a political strategy or whatever you think, if you're not understanding that subtle difference between his campaign and the other campaigns, you will never figure out how to get those voters.
Yeah.
And that is important. If you are a DNC right now struggling amongst, and we're going to talk in a little bit about the struggle.
It's real.
But that's an important thing for you to know about the Sanders coalition.
Yeah, yeah.
In any case, the caucus.
Yes. We went to one again.
We went to the caucus site that was Orr Middle School, which is in Las Vegas, not that far from the Strip. We didn't go to one of the Strip caucus sites, although there were many, obviously.
We spent a lot of time at the Strip.
more than you'd... Enough time to catch every shade of that Michael Bloomberg ad that was on the largest LED screen on the Strip.
Yeah.
And listen, if all he wants to do is needle Donald Trump on LED screens, that's fine, but don't run for president with that information. In any case... The caucuses were an interesting contrast to Iowa.
Yes.
For one thing, the precincts were much, much smaller. So this one caucus site we were at, there were two main rooms and then a few sort of scattered rooms.
Yeah.
Just the two main rooms alone, which is where we were observing, had 10 different precincts in them.
Right. Many of whom did not have more than like 50 people at them. I don't think any had a handful.
I don't think any had more than 50, actually, because I think ours, the one we like most 30, carefully were, watched, I think it was 47. Like 40 or 42. Something. It was 41. 40,
oh, right.
It was between 42 and 41. There was a little bit of a count.
We had another counting issue, but it was quickly resolved.
That's right. But so they all were like between 15 and 50 people about.
Yeah.
And they were all sharing rooms. So we were in a cafeteria at one point that had 6 precincts voting at once.
Yeah.
Then we were in a gym that had 4 precincts voting at once.
Yeah. But some of those precincts had like 8 people at them.
Right. I mean, yeah. Some of them were very tiny.
Yeah.
And then the largest ones, you know, were still very tiny. And because of that, it felt more like the intention of caucusing, which is like a community meeting.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how they opened it, by saying this is a community meeting. And in Iowa, we didn't really have that feeling because there was 353 people at our caucus site. No one could confirm that that was the number of people there.
Right.
They were in a packed room. You couldn't hear anyone.
You couldn't move around.
You couldn't chat with anyone.
Right.
It was like mayhem in there. And at this site, if you were, you know, first of all, we all spent a lot of time waiting around because there was some miscommunication about what time the doors opened versus the caucus started versus doors closed versus things.
Yeah.
So our caucus didn't actually get rolling until an hour after 12
almost
when they were supposed
to
start.
Yeah.
And so we were there for about 3 hours just waiting around. But it meant that people, because they were in these small caucus sites, were like sitting around and talking about their candidates, which felt more like what the intention of that kind of a process is. I mean, there was one guy who was real chatty. Bernie voter who kept trying to use a physics metaphor to explain why he was voting for Bernie. And I was like, tell me.
I was going to say, he started talking about a fulcrum. And I'm like, Lila's got this one for me.
But I had seen him before talking to some, I think, Warren voters or somebody about why he'd chosen Bernie over Warren.
Yeah.
And I mean, ultimately, his argument was actually the one that we have been using as well, which is, you know, you have to pull change from where you can. You can't just expect that a compromise will come to where you are. So if you are someone on the left, part of your obligation is to vote your principles because you want the compromise position to be pulled as far left as possible.
Yeah.
And so you don't compromise, before you actually start making a deal.
Right.
But so in any case, he was chatting up a storm with everyone about this. And as annoying as that was to some people, it was kind of like, you saw that happening all over the room. There were just people that were sort of like stuck sitting and waiting together. And because of that, they were sitting and having civil conversations about their candidates. We saw on the way in a Tom Steyer guy and a Bernie guy have a very nice moment. Then we have another Bernie guy who announced that he had forgotten he also needed to vote and thought he was going to come and be a precinct at his caucus, a precinct captain. And we were like, "Oh, have you already voted? Did you vote early?" And he was like, "Oh no, I guess I should vote."
About that. Yeah.
Like he had spent all weekend canvassing too. It was so weird. In any case, then there was one person, there was one Tulsi voter, and every single Bernie precinct captain, and there were a lot of them in the room because there were so many precincts, tried to come up to him and convince him to vote for, he did actually vote for Bernie.
Oh, yeah.
He was in the precinct that we ended up paying the closest attention to in the end. And then we also watched the really talkative guy had a 17-year-old nephew that he had brought just to witness the process. And 17-year-old found out he could vote.
Yeah. That was cute.
That was sweet.
Yeah. He was very excited too.
Yes, very.
Yeah.
All the other non-caucusing observers were Bernie people, by the way.
Oh my gosh.
Bernie's, and that was the case all over the state.
In the gym, there were less observers in the gym. I could think more people were in the cafeteria.
It was more exciting.
There was more action in the cafeteria. Yeah. So we left the cafeteria at some point. But there were also not only were there not as many observers in the gym, we couldn't find precinct captains specifically Liz Warren. Captains from the campaign too. Like she had, there was nobody in there, at least that was like wearing anything.
Yeah, there was no visible Liz Warren paraphernalia, people, anything in the gym.
That was not
well. Great. And I think it was we sort of weren't surprised when she didn't perform well because we were like, well, she was not visible anywhere at the caucus site that we were at, and considering how many precincts were there, that wasn't kind of bizarre. It wasn't great.
She did get some delegates at one of the precincts, I think, but only at one of them, I think.
I think out two. Of the 10 there, did I think she got like some. She got like maybe four delegates at one, and then there was that one precinct
one that split all where four of them.
They had twice as many Bernie voters as any other voter, but this is why the caucus system is stupid. They had four viable candidates, and they only had four delegates. So they had to give each one delegate. So Bernie ended up getting the same number of delegates as everyone else, even though twice as many people had showed up to support him. That's the caucus system for you. Uh-huh. Also, there were only like 20 people in that whole precinct. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
But so apparently all over the state, there were Bernie observers and no one else. He had a ground game there that was not to be trifled with. I mean, if you're sitting to yourself wondering how he won the Latino vote, it is by going and asking for it.
Yes.
Basically. I mean, he sent people he's been doing this for a while because he did that Spanish language town hall in Nevada where AOC gave that speech. Yep. And we saw when he came to L.A., he was the rally that we went to for him in L.A. was in East L.A. They had Spanish speakers there. They gave speeches in Spanish.
They had a Spanish language band.
Right. So, I mean, he's been doing outreach to the Latino community for a while, but he is really focused on that in Nevada. And it showed.
Yeah.
That was very clear. So in any case, everything was finally done by 2:30, only 4.5 hours after we'd arrived.
Right. They don't need to open the doors that early, by the way.
They don't need to open the doors more than half an hour before the caucus because it turns out they're going to start them late no matter what.
Right. What would have started that caucus on time was more people checking people in, but they were short volunteers.
Yeah. Well, and I can tell them why.
Yeah.
It's because when you have 100,000 precincts and caucus sites all over the state, you need too many volunteers.
Right.
That's an inefficient system.
The precinct that we were paying the most attention to did not have a volunteer. Now, the woman who ran the site did a very good job.
Right.
She was like a former state senator.
Yeah. And she's been the youngest female state senator, I think, ever elected. She didn't announce that till the end.
She did a very good job. We waited around for a while to try and tell her that she did a good job because we'd seen some horror shows.
Right. But she was busy.
But she was very busy. She was doing math, so we left her alone.
The site right next to ours had like a wannabe comedian running it.
Comedian.
We kept hearing uproarious laughter from them. And it was like, and at one point he was supposed to read a thing that said, "I have signed an impartiality agreement, blah, blah, blah." And then he turned to them and was like, "Well, I haven't, but I'll move on."
Right.
So,
apparently nobody signed those, by the way.
Well, none of these people had been trained.
Right.
There were all of these people leading these caucus sites Were either, like, you know, there was a big call, like a frenzied call in California for volunteers to come over and help run the caucus this year. And we actually had, we had dinner that night with some friends who had worked, you know, had volunteered to help run caucus sites and do tech work with the DNC. And by the way, they said this went much more smoothly than they expected, in part because the system that they ended up settling on was, it sounded a little labor intensive, but it was, it was secure.
Well, right, it secure worked. And redundancy upon upon redundancy.
So the I don't think that we'll have the issue like we had in Iowa where no one can even knows if the results are real once they start coming out.
Yeah.
But they said that the system relied on something like 3,000 volunteers. And I was like, that's insane. Because, first of all, election poll workers get paid.
Right.
So when you have a regular election, you're not asking for volunteer labor. You are getting a bunch of incompetent old ladies to come work or whatever, but they're getting paid.
Yeah.
And that is, you can't pay, you know, a massive volunteer force to operate the world's most inefficient voting system.
No.
The whole idea is it's, and on some level it was nice that they weren't trained in every precinct because it was like an actual community meeting. They were voters from that district.
Oh yeah, and people were helping each other. Right. That was the, it was cooperative. Also very, and I think also that is due to the small size.
Yes,
too.
Totally.
It feels much more, it felt much more cooperative. The speeches that people gave were very good. They were applauded by everyone. Mm-hmm. The caucus site that we were paying the most attention to, the precinct, like when it was over, somebody got up and like gave like a huge speech about
the census.
Everybody doing the census, and everybody applauded that. I mean, it felt like, and there were multiple campaigns that were viable there. So like it could have, there was never,
there were campaigns and there was never much ideology.
Right, there was never a moment in any of the precincts, at least that we could have eyes on, that didn't feel like totally constructive.
Right. Totally.
Which I think is sort of like the idea as to why these things should be done in the way that they're done. I mean, it's sort of like, I feel like a lot of people probably left the site that we were at and felt like they could vote blue no matter who.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, totally. Like in a way, it's sort of like, and it's like you said, that's the one thing that you do like about the system is sort of like the talking to your neighbors. This felt more like that than Iowa did.
Yes. Oh, yeah. In Iowa, I mean, I had sort of sensed that I liked that about Iowa because you did get a chance to go make pitches to voters.
Right.
But this felt like a forum where it was actually comfortable to do that. It wasn't like you were having to, in a room of 350 people, find random wandering people and be like, are you the one Michael Bennett voter?
Right.
Like, this felt more like a community meeting where everyone came together and was like, here's what we think the candidate should be. And, you know, how should we give, we have these delegates to give out. How should we give them out? They all had the early vote numbers handy, which was something we had been concerned might not be the case.
Yes.
And a lot of those sites, more people showed up for early voting than actually showed up on the day.
Yeah.
So the early vote numbers changed everything very dramatically. And there were some issues with that because, you know, obviously you can't make an informed second alignment as an early voter. You get to pick, I think, up to five choices so that you can finally, you know, you can align with somebody.
Right.
So it's more like ranked choice voting, which is nice, but mixed in with the caucus, it's kind of confusing. It's not the most democratic possible system. But also, you know what is a great compromise between caucuses and primaries?
Just doing ranked choice voting.
Ranked choice voting. That's it, you guys.
Yeah.
That's it. So in any case, we still only have 72% of the results in. They warned us that it would be slow, and they're right. It's been slow.
Yeah.
But Bernie, it was called for Bernie within seconds because
when there was like 0%.
Lead is massive and continues to be massiver.
Yeah.
He's currently with 72% and he's now leading by 27 points.
Yep.
And this, the only other person who's even viable in the field so far is Joe Biden.
Yeah, those two look
like they're Buttigieg has wavered a bit in between viability and non-viability.
And about 10 minutes before this updated to 72%, it was previously at 50%. Buttigieg had 15 point something or other. And literally, as this was updating, we were seeing that he is claiming that he's going to challenge some of the results. So he is very clearly concerned that he's not going to have anything to show for himself out of this, which is surprising since he declared victory yesterday.
I mean, it's so weird. Him and Joe Biden both declared victory at their speeches.
Great. Yeah.
But yeah, it was a disappointing showing for Warren, we said, but also for Steyer, who had really, I think, thought.
Polling in the double digits in a lot of places, it's like you said, like if you don't get to 15, like he may have had higher, and I think he actually is overperforming in raw vote total than he is in amount of delegates because like he had some supporters, but they just had to go elsewhere because they weren't at 15% of a room.
And that's part of the stress of that system.
Right, of a caucus.
System. Yeah. But this is honest. This is not a great showing for Buttigieg. He didn't show he can expand his appeal with voters of color. He's not in delegate territory.
Yeah.
It just, I think goes to show that he's about to be in for some rough, some rough results. Because I don't see South Carolina being another place where he rakes in the new voters. You know,
certainly not. No. So it was a real shellacking. By the way, that is the same level of support that Bernie Sanders had in a two-way race in 2016. So if you're here to tell me that all the moderates need to do is just coalesce around one person, I got news for you.
No, that's not it. Also, because with Warren, him plus Warren are well over 50%. The progressives won that race by a margin. So, so the question I don't think that we want to ask with at least diverse and more representative states, the conversation is not which moderate drops out so that we can finally beat Bernie Sanders. It's sort of like, what do we do to get these Sanders voters back?
Right.
I mean, if that's the question, if you are so concerned about a Sanders presidency that you feel the need to take action, your action should not be, what do we do to beat Bernie Sanders?
Right.
It should be, how do we woo these voters?
Yeah.
That's all you can do. It's too late. You lost the thread a little bit. So
they've definitely lost the thread.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've big time lost the thread.
Yeah. Well, and the entrance and exit polling here showed Bernie leading with
everyone. Subgroup that they polled, basically, in the entrance results.
Basically.
The makeup of the electorate was 65% white, and then 18% Hispanic or Latino, and 11% black.
Right.
So it's easily the most diverse state that we've had so far. South Carolina is going to be even more so. But this has always been and this is what I'm seeing, and I think this is the reason why everybody's panicking. Because it's weird that everybody's panicking, because there were polls that showed that this was to happen. The day of, there was a poll that came out that had Sanders up 19%, and you and I saw that, and we were both like, all right, pump the brakes, everybody. Right. But then meanwhile, that just was...
He's at 27 now.
Right, so they were underestimated it was going to be. There has been this sort of like, well, let's just wait. You know, these first two states don't matter because Sanders won.
Right.
And I'm just going with the narrative Sanders won Iowa because he won raw votes, and he's actually only behind like 0.01%
in the delegates. And he's like, getting the same number of delegates.
And they're getting the same number of delegates, and they're actually doing some recounts on behalf of both of Sanders and Buttigieg. So who knows what's going on in Iowa. So if you don't know who has the most delegates, then you have to fall back on the raw vote, and Sanders won that. So Sanders won Iowa as far as I'm concerned. Right. I don't care. And then he won New Hampshire. And so the narrative has been, well, A, he hasn't gotten 30% in any of these states, which is the thing that they just made up recently. Right.
He couldn't get 30%.
Right. And then also, like, let's just wait and see until a state with someone other than a white person in it votes, and let's just see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was
that everyone else got their asses handed to them.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean,
big time. He won with white voters, 31 to 19%. 19% was Buttigieg, and then Klobuchar was 14%. Warren was 14%. And working class Joe, former person who like was the king of getting white people to vote for him, 12%.
I love this. Is like continues to be my favorite narrative of this cycle.
So good.
Is that every time Biden underperforms, everyone's like, "Oh, it's just hard. He doesn't do well with white voters."
Right,
and it's like, first of all, he's going to win the general election by not doing well with white voters. Like, it's fine to be someone who does well with black voters. That's very important.
Sure.
It is also important to do well with white voters, though. You have to do well with different kinds of voters.
Right.
You can't do notably badly with white voters and then be like, "But I'm the most electable."
Right.
And then be like, "But of course, you guys knew I didn't do well with white voters." Like, since when did Joe Biden, who got added to the Obama ticket to bring white voters in, become a person who can't get a white person to vote for them? Right. This is madness.
Exactly.
In any case.
But the Hispanic vote was where he really made, where he won.
Yeah.
A huge, big time.
Sanders won 54%.
54%. Biden, 14%. He won by 40% there. Buttigieg at 9%, Warren at 7%, and Klobuchar at 5%. And look, that is a winning coalition in Nevada, certainly. But also, I think it certainly is in the general election. But it also, and this is why I think everybody is sort of like shitting themselves, is you've got Texas and California coming up.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at 54%, anywhere near 54% for Sanders with Hispanic voters in either of those places, you are cooked.
Yeah. Well, and it was a devious strategy that he enacted to just go into Hispanic communities
and
listen to them and then also ask for their votes.
Right, exactly.
It was It's been a really devious,
I know,
sneaky strategy he's been working on.
I know, how dare
he? Where he just decided maybe I should campaign to Hispanic voters, and then maybe they will vote for me in return.
Yeah.
It seems like no one else banked on that strategy, which is interesting because it's honestly the only strategy.
Yeah. Well, and this is what we were talking about this on the way home, too. We had a 4.5-hour drive. We could have recorded six podcasts on the drive home
from Las Vegas. I did think to myself, I was like, should we just record this drive? And then I was like, I'm not editing that together.
Right. Yeah. But he... another thing that people aren't giving him, and I realize we're only three states in, that people aren't giving him enough credit for here, is that he has run a masterful campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that he was able to do this here in Nevada and has also had the foresight to be doing what he's doing. You know, he's winning in Texas, if you're to believe those polls, and that's because he has been laying the seeds there for a really long time. And the same in California. You know, you mentioned that rally that was in East Los Angeles that he had. That was long before anybody else had even dreamt of coming here.
Yeah. And I mean, and as you probably recall from being a loyal listener to this podcast, he's one of the only he's the only candidate that came in 2016 to do anything other than fundraise.
Right.
He's been laying roots here for a while, and so he had communities to come into.
Right. So I think in a general election, it might behoove all of us to have someone who is acting like he has some semblance of knowing what he's doing.
Well, especially given the shenanigans that are going on with the rest of these candidates.
The rest of them.
I mean, the rest of these candidates.
I mean, we love Warren, but her campaign has been a disaster.
She's made horrible mistakes.
And Pete Buttigieg is just out there gaslighting us and can't win a vote from anybody other than like a 40-year-old white person.
Is a limited edition type thing, because at a certain point, you start hearing that he's gaslighting you.
Right.
Or you start hearing that he's not saying anything.
Right.
You can only do that for so long before people are like, wait, what do you mean?
Right, and Joe Biden, I mean, at the risk of sounding like Donald Trump, is just a loser.
I mean, in the sense... The most famous presidential loser in history.
In the sense of a person who... And I only say that because his campaign was about winning.
Right.
So
no, exactly.
I wouldn't have called him a loser otherwise. Don't... You know, I'm not...
He's not a loser.
I'm not here to insult him. I'm just saying that, like...
He's not a... We don't mean loser in the broad sense, but he's not winning. He's a non-winner
also,
of this campaign,
if you're
or any.
For a campaign that, like, might be able to sort of, like, put together some sort of... semblance of a campaign that might win something, they seem to have the answers so far. It's the Sanders campaign that has the answers.
Well, that's what you get when you've been working with organizers. You know, the left, if they're up to anything, it's organizing communities.
Yeah.
And that is why I think you're also seeing sort of new voters brought into the process. That's part of what a far left campaign can offer. And maybe that's not everything, obviously.
Yeah. Sure.
It's not money.
Right.
But he's also getting money, so that's working out fine. But it's part of the benefit of an experience campaign, and then a campaign that is also sort of hinging on deputizing people to feel like this is their responsibility too.
He did lose with black voters, but it was very close. Biden was 34%, and then Sanders was 28%. Warren was 12%, and then Klobuchar was at 3%, and Buttigieg was at 2%. Yeesh.
Hello, South Carolina.
Somebody. I know.
Oh, yeah, right? hello somebody. As in the words of Nina Turner.
Yeah. Sanders also won every single age range except 65 and older. And then the 17 to 29-year-old voters, he won 68% of that vote.
Yeah. Keep in mind, you guys, that there were like a million other candidates. He didn't win it against one other candidate.
Right.
That margin with that many candidates,
is crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah. He also, this I find amazing.
Yeah.
He won with very liberal, which you would expect, somewhat liberal, maybe also to expect somewhat. But then also... eked out a victory with moderate / conservative voters.
That's so weird.
Wow.
But hey.
But like also.
Winning
like,
coalition.
We can. That's it. And that is
why. Pete Buttigieg is out there telling us that he's the only one who can build a coalition of different ideologies.
Based
but that
on,
seems like one.
Based on nothing. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Based on nothing.
Also,
Sanders.
Oh, yeah.
Also won with people who had decided in the last few days, as we mentioned before.
Right.
So that means that he was the one. Despite Warren's debate momentum, Sanders had sort of an insurmountable amount of momentum going into this
race. Well, and I think it was momentum. And also, I think part of the reason why he won in those last couple days goes back to, again, his operation there.
Yeah.
That is the amount of doors that they knocked on in the 72 hours leading up to the caucus. That was the commitment of people to make sure that people got to the caucus.
Yeah.
I mean, it was – that's how you win of that particular piece of the electorate is just your final push, basically, which he was able to execute better than anybody else was.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the exit polling on issues is also interesting.
Yes.
Because once again, right. And this is
our third state.
If anyone
in a row.
Else is wondering what's going on here, here's something.
Yeah.
44% of the people in exit polls said that healthcare was their number one issue.
It has been.
It has been
the first
in every state, and it's been by a huge margin.
Right.
6 in 10 voters said that they supported single payer healthcare, which is also something that has been consistent
also,
in every race.
And in the question, because sometimes this is where you find, depending on how that question is asked, people will say that they're for Medicare for all, but then they also say that they don't want private insurance eliminated.
Right.
So they're basically thinking that what Pete Buttigieg is offering is Medicare for all.
Right.
So I think sometimes that question is not necessarily asked in a way that you get a very clear answer. But this specifically was. This 6 in 10 number that we just gave you, 60% of people were asked whether they were in favor of single-payer healthcare, even if it meant eliminating private insurance. Yeah. So they understood the question, presumably, anyway, because it was asked in a way that was very clear. About
also,
what Medicare for All actually means.
Among those people who believed in single-payer healthcare,
guess
who a majority of those people...
Well, right.
Guess who had a lot of members who... A majority of members who also agreed with that. That's the culinary we're seeing.
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
I talked my way around that.
Sorry, no, that's okay.
Because I got confused. I think I got confused because I just want to point out we just had a small earthquake. Did you notice that?
No.
Yeah.
We did?
We did.
Oh, my God.
I thought it was just me, maybe like my pulse, but then I
feel
heard everything shake. And I was like, well, I didn't cause that. So just FYI. If you're wondering why I was just flustered there.
Oh, my God.
We had a small earthquake. Back to the point.
Amazing.
Bernie won at most of the sites on the Strip that had culinary workers in them. That was the union that said that they were adamantly opposed to single-payer health care.
Right.
There were 7 caucus sites on the Strip on Saturday. Sanders won at 5 and tied at another. Those are the sites where the culinary workers union has most of their workers.
Yeah, and they were asked about that. There was an article about this specifically, and people asked some of the culinary workers why it was that when their union leaders were so against him, why they voted for him. And they were like, what happens if I lose my job?
Right. The age-old question.
Duh. That's right? it. And also, and they also said, I have friends and family that don't have any health insurance. So they're able to understand empathy.
Well, also, Nevada has one of the highest jobless rates in the country.
Yeah,
of course they fucking
understand
that.
Higher than the national
average.
Yeah.
I mean, that's that, of course, anyone who knows people who don't work in from their union understands this inherently. And you know, most unions also get this. But there has been this sort of weird attempt by some of facets of the labor movement to try to kind of like stymie the single-payer health discussion in an effort to kind of maintain one of their bargaining chips.
Yeah.
But also, as anyone who is a union member can know to themselves, oftentimes, I saw people tweeting about this today where they were like, yeah, my union has gotten me raises and they have often gotten eaten away by rises in health insurance costs.
Yeah.
So they often never, they often don't become, turn into actual raises. If unions didn't have to negotiate for benefits, then unions could just negotiate you a raise.
Yeah.
That,
yeah, totally.
You know, they wouldn't have to use this bargaining chip of like making sure you don't die in a
That's
gutter to get you a
Like at the debate on Wednesday, Pete Buttigieg sort of like dinged Sanders for this because he was just sort of like, they put their blood, sweat, and tears into getting this health insurance. And Sanders tried to answer in the best way that he could at the time, which maybe was not the best answer. You know, let's face it. He's not always the best at these debates. He does fine. And that's often good enough.
He's reflecting my rage.
It's whatever. He's right, exactly. But obviously, the answer to that is, I don't want them to have to put their blood, sweat, and tears
this
into getting these healthcare plans.
Effort for something that everyone should already have.
Right. Yeah.
Like
they will never have to do that again under my plan.
But this also led me to believe that I've been thinking a lot about this. The Buttigieg talking point that he's using to sort of ding Sanders for Medicare for All is, well, they're going to kick everyone off their health insurance.
Oh, yeah.
And that was something that Hillary Clinton and her surrogates got dragged for in the last election because it is so misleading and so kind of, you know, it's so sort of like outwardly untruthful.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people know that by now.
Well,
I'm curious why he can't think of a better
talking
point.
Right, I think so too. Well, and you mentioned something to me too, and I was like, oh, I hadn't really thought about this, even though all the numbers are sort of there to point to this being completely true. But I think you're absolutely right in the sense that anybody who decided to run against Medicare for All in this race made a tactical error.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because we all, leading up to this race, you know, 2 years ago, sort of assumed that Medicare for All was going to be a litmus test in this presidential race. Right. And even the candidates themselves, I think, thought so. Because, you know, we love to talk about that Pete Buttigieg tweet from like a year and a half ago where he was like, nobody had ever supported Medicare for All more than Pete Buttigieg had.
Right.
And Kamala Harris, when she got into the race, was saying that she didn't know what she thought, but her initial response was she didn't care whether we got rid of private insurance companies.
Her instinct was to be for Medicare for
All. And I think what happened was they realized that they just couldn't beat Bernie and Liz on that issue.
Yeah.
And so instead of just also coming along on the issue and just sort of like ceding that particular issue to them, they took a different tack.
Yeah.
They took the Hillary Clinton angle and they went against it. They started telling us all the reasons why we can't have it. They start giving us cockamamie plans that aren't going to cover everyone and still going to leave people, you know, uninsured and dying
and in debt, for sure.
In bankruptcy.
Right.
And that, I think, is proving, especially after these first three states where all three of them have said that they want Medicare for All, I think they messed up.
Yeah.
And they're in too deep now to go back on it, I think. It may be that specific issue that becomes the moderate undoing.
I mean, I think it should be, first of all.
Yeah.
Because it's the one that is most directly tied to every single person in America's ability to live a happy, unfettered, you know, debt-free existence.
Yeah, I mean, it's no wonder that it's everybody's most important issue. Yeah, especially with the cost the way they are.
As Michael Bennett might say, it's personal to me, as it is to everyone, because everyone has a body and health, or a lack thereof.
Yeah.
But I also said to Brent earlier, while we were walking through a mall in Vegas, I was like, I don't understand why at some point the DNC sort of, you know, didn't just say this, we have to disinvest from this industry. There are a million, we can continue to service a million special corporate needs. We can continue to be beloved by zillionaires. We can continue to make sure that Bloomberg LLC is the most profitable business in the history of the face of the planet.
Yeah.
But we have got to disinvest from health insurance because the health insurance industry is going to bring us down. We are too, our sort of connections to both big pharma and to the insurance industry have meant that we can't come out for the one issue that makes us electable in an easy fashion. We are forced into a position where we're having to use unpopular, dated, ridiculous talking points to discredit an idea that the rest of the world knows is a good idea. And there is proof everywhere that it works.
Right.
So it's not hard to find proof that a single payer system is a good idea. It's literally, if you call anyone in any other country on earth and ask them about their healthcare, they will not know what you're talking about when you wonder how they pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, the proof is there.
Yeah.
So they have been forced by this one sector to rely on a losing strategy.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they weren't just like, how do we keep the rest of the money? The Sanders thing gave them a clue.
Yeah.
You know, he was like, you know, he was the one who put it on the table. And then suddenly everyone was like, well, wait a minute. This is the thing. This is what we're for. But I don't understand why the sort of powers that be weren't like, okay, well, we have to figure out how to extricate ourselves from this one kind of, you know, relationship.
Yeah.
Because this one relationship is going to tank us if we don't figure out a way to move forward on it.
Totally.
And especially when they couldn't even pass a public option, when they couldn't even get meaningful healthcare reform to stay. You know, they passed the ACA. And listen, like we said at the time, I'm not here to shit on the ACA because I think anything that expands health coverage is a good idea on some level.
Sure.
I think that the public option is a long-term bad idea. I've said that before as well. But I think that they should have seen that once you're up against that kind of pressure, you have to make sure that you don't answer to those people that are providing the pressure anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been so much more sensible for them to get out of the game of opposing single payer healthcare and get into the game of loving Wall Street again and not like work for other different rich people.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, you know, there has been so much panic, a lot of it coming from MSNBC, which we're going to get to. But one of the things that I think they are panicked about, and also sort of some of these people who are running down ticket are supposedly panicked about or are going to be panicked about or whatever. Yeah. But like, you know, there's all this hand wringing of like, what are some of these people who are running statewide going to do with someone like Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket? And it should be clear, if you dig into any sort of numbers, especially on Medicare for All, that the thing that you should do is embrace it with open arms.
Yeah.
Because that is the, that's the win right there. I mean, like, if you're looking at Nevada, who, well, and also it polls well nationwide anyway. But
it polls well with Republicans.
But my guess is that near every single state that we get to is going to have over 50% in favor of Medicare for All.
Yeah.
And in the places that do, you're going to see Sanders doing very well in. So if you are a person who's running in a congressional seat in one of those states, let's say it's Texas, and you're wondering whether you should be running on Medicare for All when 6 in 10 of the people in the state think it's a good idea and Bernie Sanders has just won there, like, saddle yourself up to Bernie Sanders, for fuck's sake. That's the answer.
Right. Well,
this is not hard.
It's like, it's so wild how intent everyone is on, because, well, here's what happens. There are very vocal opponents to single payer.
Sure.
And those opponents are the kind of people that you hear from as a politician.
Right.
But you also...
And you take checks from.
And you take checks from. Exactly. But it's not where the voters are. At a certain point, part of your job running for office is to determine where the sort of money versus votes line has to be for you.
Yeah.
Because at a certain point, it doesn't matter how much money you have if you can't get elected.
Right.
And this issue polls well everywhere.
Yes.
And it's only going to keep polling better because the more people find out about it, the more sense it makes.
Yes.
And the only talking points anyone on the moderate or right has been able to produce against it are talking points that we debunked in the 80s.
Right.
So it doesn't make any sense to continue to sort of move in with your head in the sand in the absolute wrong direction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, in any case, speaking of people that have kept their heads in the sand,
woo,
MSNBC... lost the thread this weekend.
They really did.
They were the biggest story out of Nevada, and it was because their coverage was wackadoo insane.
Oh my God.
Led,
you guys.
Led by the inimitable Chris Matthews.
He had a mental break yesterday.
He might lose his job over
this.
And the reason he might lose his job is because he compared the Sanders' electoral success to Francis fought in Nazi Germany in World War II. And as much as that is in bad taste, no matter what. And listen, Chuck Todd's already called Sanders supporters brown shirts.
Yeah.
It's especially in bad taste when the candidate is Jewish. They've got to stop making Nazi references to the Sanders people. It always gets them into trouble. And you know what?
Yeah.
They should know better.
It does.
You should, first of all, we got to stop making Nazi references to things that are not Nazis anyway.
Yeah.
But specifically, when we're talking about people whose families escaped Nazi Germany or escaped Nazi occupation elsewhere, you got to use your head.
Totally.
He didn't, though.
No, he didn't. He also wondered on air if it would be better for moderate Democrats if Sanders got the nomination and then just didn't win the election.
Yeah.
And then they could just get somebody else they want in there later after 4 years of
Sanders. Who suggested maybe we just let Trump win.
Yes.
Is what he suggested.
Yeah.
It would literally be preferable to Chris Matthews if Donald Trump was the president for another 4 years than if Bernie Sanders was the president.
That's right. Yes.
This is also a man who doesn't think Bernie can get anything done. But somehow it is worse for him to have a president he doesn't believe can get anything done than to have Donald Trump.
Yeah, totally. Oh, there was also, I feel like we skipped it when we were talking about the culinary unions, but there was a hilarious clip from MSNBC where they had a reporter in one of those caucus sites, and they were like, we're here at one of the caucus sites where many culinary union people are. And they were like, and it looks like they're voting for Bernie Sanders.
There's like this long audible sigh.
It was so good. I think that might actually have been my favorite clip.
Oh,
of all
that's
of these.
Definitely,
I mean,
the funniest.
Certainly watching Chris Matthews have like a mental break is enjoyable. There was that funny tweet from Patton Oswalt that was like, I'm for Elizabeth Warren, but if like voting for Bernie Sanders means that you're going to get to watch Chris, he made a weird reference.
Yeah,
I didn't get
his head explode like
or something. But I mean, what Bernie is doing to Chris Matthews right now is
must-see
TV.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like it to go away.
I would like it to go away.
But if you haven't had the pleasure of seeing it, you should definitely find it online because it's
do it before he does go away.
Right, exactly.
Because there are lots of calls for him to resign.
He should have had to
resign after 2016. He like, and this is something that has been sort of like a slow brewing storm.
Yeah.
But he is a man who is truly just not processing what's going on here.
Right.
And listen, for years he was sort of processing what was going on. So it was fine.
When he was
on the air. And he was processing things.
Right.
He's always been a bit of a blowhard, but he was capable of reporting the news at one time.
Yeah.
This moment in history has not caught up to it. He truly doesn't understand what's going on, and it is making it impossible for him to report the news.
Right, and not only, and this is what I think, Anand Giridharadas is on MSNBC, and, you know, he definitely does know what's going on, and he's one of the contributors.
When he's been an advocate of them finding out.
Right, and that is what I think that is, like, Sanders supporters are obviously mad at MSNBC, and they have every single right to be. But what I think that the people who are sort of, like, pushing back about that, it's like, oh, here go the Sanders supporters, like, wanting MSNBC to just endorse Bernie Sanders. That's not what we're looking for.
No.
What we're looking for is, as people who do the news and are being paid good and well to be on our television, to at least attempt to explain to us what it is that is going on in the world, to have some fucking curiosity about what it is that's going on in the world. That's all we're asking for them. I don't expect Chris Matthews to ever fully wrap his head around this. He's 74, and he's been in politics, like, working on the Hill and for Democrats and Republicans, and, you know, he comes from the old school, like, way of thinking, and, like, there's nothing wrong with that, per se, at least in terms of sort of, like, okay, that's your thing.
It shouldn't prevent you from reporting the news.
But it shouldn't prevent you from sort of, like, having some thought to yourself, like, I wonder why this is happening.
Yeah.
That's really what we're asking from Chris Matthews.
When we
and he has zero care in the world other than to just shit on what is ultimately anywhere between 30 and 50% of the party in which he belongs to.
Yeah. And we saw that it's possible because Joy-Ann Reid tried it this weekend.
She did.
And she's been a thorn in the side of Sanders people for years. And the side of the left, honestly, for years.
And
she's one of the most oft-quoted annoying people on MSNBC.
And mine for just other reasons, because I think that she's just actually truly awful. And she is also a person who should not be allowed to give us the news because she's a liar. But regardless, that's a separate story.
Separate story.
She does seem to be, and it was almost happened over the course of the day. Like, if you watch clips from her, like, the understanding seems to get deeper as the day goes on. There was one clip from earlier in the day where she was, like, talking about Sanders supporters, like, being so angry, and they're mad, and they're this, and blah, 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 blah. And she sort of almost accurately described it, but with judgment in the way that she was saying it, and then also sort of, like, ended it by saying, like, Democrats are going to have to figure out what they're going to do with this, sort of, like, in a way that's sort of, like, how do we defeat this? And then sort of by the end of the day, having a very sort of, like, lovely conversation with Nina Turner from the Sanders campaign in a way that made it seem sort of like she was at least making an attempt to get it. And it was notable enough that Anand, who was on later in the day, actually being interviewed by her, congratulated her for, like, him being able to see that she is sort of, like, at least attempting to, like, do the work. Like, she's trying.
Yeah.
And she should be applauded for that. She should also get off my television.
Right.
But, like, you know.
No, but I mean, it's.
But, like, it was if she's going to be on it, then, like, kudos, I guess.
Well, that's it was a stark contrast to Chris Matthews, because the two of them are sort of the
and
two
James
biggest
blowhards. And James Carville was gone there doing insane things and talking about socialism and whatever else. And Nicole Wallace said that he was using the dark arts. And, I mean, it was a whole day of insanity on MSNBC.
And it was also a whole day of news anchors who theoretically cover this race all the time, continually referring to Bernie Sanders as a socialist.
Right, which they know he's not.
Yeah. So it was biased news coverage, and I get it. MSNBC is biased news coverage. It is becoming more and more like Fox News in the sense that it is becoming more and more truthy and less truthful every day, though.
But I also just sort of, like, and you and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday, I don't get how this makes sense for them either.
Who is the audience for this?
I mean, like, sure, maybe establishment Democrats like that, but, like, all Democrats were watching MSNBC. I mean, to a degree, you are only losing large amounts of viewers with this. I mean, I've seen a lot of people who are now sort of, like, watching The Hill because Crystal Ball is the person who is getting this.
She's
and
the gettiest.
And again, I want to, like, be clear that we're not looking for news sources who are endorsing Bernie Sanders. Like, that's not what I want. Like, I would prefer that I am watching a news source that, like, has not done so. But, like, even CNN on their panel has that, you know, that Latina who
She's from Justice Democrats.
Right, and who worked on the Sanders campaign in 2016.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of these, at least, they're putting on people who are at least able to explain to the non-getters on CNN, because there's certainly some over there as well.
Of course.
Like, but MSNBC hasn't even, you know, they did have Nina Turner on last night, but just in terms of their actual, like, panel coverage of, like, how they are interpreting the results that are coming in during their broadcast are not including any of those people. I think Anand should be on those broadcasts.
I agree. And
because he's the one person on their network who is actually a contributor to their network who can make sense of it.
Yeah. And I have felt myself being in the unenviable position of recommending that people watch all of their coverage on CNN when there's elections.
I know.
Because I think they don't do sensationalistic crap all the time, but because I feel like they have, once you are CNN, which is a completely bullshit network, as people on the right and left know, you have at least found it in your brain space to think, okay, well, something is happening in politics right now. We should make sure that that viewpoint that represents this huge swath of people is represented on our network if we're going to have panels discussing everything. That's why, even though when their panels were always like a million people, I was like, listen, at least they fit everyone in. You know, the viewpoints are all there. There's a lot of uninformed pundits on there, but there's also activists on CNN.
Yeah.
CNN has just like done the work to try to figure out how to find some of the viewpoints that we're not seeing explained on the news.
You might have to listen to Rick Santorum before you get to it.
Right, that's a frustrating part of the experience. But it's just like, it's worth it in order to have someone be able to answer Rick Santorum without just people, like it's felt like CNN panel, I mean, MSNBC
like
panels have just been feeding
MSNBC not have someone to be like, whoa, Chris?
Right?
You know, like that's...
Well, and that's... How does MSNBC not have someone from the Justice Democrats wing of the party on their network?
Yeah.
They have wonks, but all of these people are sort of insider people at this point. Like, they... And their most public coverage is being done by people who, like, legit have no understanding of what's going on.
Totally.
And how could they not see it?
Yeah.
I mean, how could the people that run the network not with their own eyes see it? I mean,
And they seemed so shocked about yesterday, too, when all signs were pointing to that being what was going to happen.
Well, that's the other thing. It was like the polls were showing that he had like a 20-point lead. Like, are they really that shocked that he won?
I know. It was so weird.
I mean, they reacted as if he had come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Instead of coming out of polling in the lead in literally every race that is currently being polled.
Yeah.
In any case, we need to talk about some of the candidate speeches. I know we briefly mentioned them, but I forced Brent to listen to me do a reading of the first line of Pete Buttigieg's speech about 12 times in the car. And that is because I was describing it as an impressionist painting where I can almost make out the edges, but once I look closely at it, I like lose the thread.
Uh-huh.
This is the first line of his speech. And then he also tweeted it and people were not having it. To those who questioned whether a Midwestern mayor could gather a national movement around a new kind of politics, you are the answer. What? To everyone who believes in what we're building, this is your night. This is your campaign. These are like words that I've heard before, but they don't come together to form any sort of complete thought.
Or meaning. And I think if you were to ask him, I think that he thinks that there's deep meaning here.
Right, but probably. Can't find it.
No, it's not there.
I'm struggling.
Just stop looking.
Because.
For starters.
First of all.
You're going to hurt yourself.
The context is. He's giving this speech at a time where he's about to come in third.
And not get any delegates. We've lost by 30-something points.
Correct. We're coming in. This is at a time when he has once again proven that he can't build a diverse coalition.
Right. Which he also talked about in his speech.
And to start his speech with. First of all. People have questioned whether a Midwestern mayor could gather a national movement around a new kind of politics, but the answer on that night, well, the answer on Saturday
night
was no.
Right.
And what does you or the answer mean? Just what?
Yeah. He's trying to Obama this, but not in a way.
But
that
he's not good.
Actually, I know. Well, that's
Obama also said sentences that made sense.
Correct.
In any case, I was so furious about that tweet for reasons that escape me that I did a dramatic reading of it to Brent at least 12 times in the car and then forced him to discuss it with me ad nauseum. He's super sick of it, but I don't care.
It's what I realized at a certain point. I was like, oh, he's doing what Trump does. Honestly,
yes.
He is going around. He is taking the what did not happen and then saying that it happened.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. Like that's what he's doing. He's like talking as if. Like, he's just had some sort of, like, victory in Nevada because everybody in Nevada decided that they are following the movement of some Midwestern mayor, which did not happen. And then he's also, in his speech, talking about Sanders not being able to put together a diverse coalition on the day when he has just put together the most diverse coalition, and you are the person who can't get anyone who is a non-white person to vote for you.
Correct.
He's gaslighting us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... And once Brent said that, everything made sense. Brent, I feel like, has been my Buttigieg whisperer for this entire race. Like, we went to that rally.
God, I don't like that. I wish I didn't know.
No, I think it's actually a really great skill. Because I think part of it is just, like, you know how there is, like, in sort of Midwest culture, there's, like, a way that people are subtly cruel to each other that makes it sound like everyone's being really polite all the time, totally. But in fact, they're being super mean. And in New York, we just yell at each other and say, fuck you.
Yeah.
But in the Midwest, you say, bless your heart, or whatever, you know? I feel like you are sort of uniquely able to read the, like, hopes and dreams of this weird kind of Midwestern-y movement that's going on here. Because you,
or
like...
Or non-movement, right,
of grouping. Because you, like... You can, like, read between the lines a little bit about what these people could be seeing. It was like when you noticed that people in Iowa probably like him because he quotes scripture a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, that would have never occurred to me because I tune out when he does that. Sure. And then I'm mad at him about it.
Yeah.
But, like, I feel like there's something, like, very sort of, like, aggressively Midwestern about what he's constantly attempting. And then more devious it's gotten, the more polite it's gotten.
Right.
And so I've been having a hard time just reading it because I don't understand what's happening. I'm just, like, listening to this guy say words, and I don't understand what the words mean. Yeah. And I hate when I don't understand something.
Yeah. Well, and he's, like, the king of, like, putting together words that, like, I mean, he's like basically just, like, a generator of, yeah, he does a word salad. Like, there was that, like, Crystal Ball retweeted him the other night, like, because his campaign put out an infographic that was, like, democracy is us and you and what we make it and... You know, like,
right.
Whatever.
It's just, I mean, like, it was words. Just,
it was like a collection of words. It had something to do with democracy. Right. I can't remember. But, like, when she retweeted it, she was like, imagine saying this and thinking it was important enough to put on an infographic. And, like, I feel like that is, like, what his entire campaign is right now. It's like him thinking that he's saying important enough things for infographics.
Right. And it's all word salad.
And none of them are.
He did use his entire speech to just attack Sanders.
Yeah, it was like five full minutes of just, like...
Of, like, a Sanders takedown. But he kept... So he was really leaning into the Sanders is divisive thing by saying, you know, he said...
Right, he started that at the debate.
Right, and he said, this is a real difference from Senator Sanders' revolution with the tenor of combat and division and polarization leading to a future where whoever wins the day, nothing changes the toxic tone of our politics. But I would say it's pretty fucking toxic to be gaslighting everyone by basically declaring victory constantly in things that you're not winning and then pretending that there are... That non-facts are facts.
Right.
But then he also attacked Sanders by saying that he was going to do harm to down-ticket races.
Right. Classic.
And first of all, I want to say something about that. One thing he said is that we have to do absolutely everything to keep Nancy Pelosi as speaker. And I want to say that we don't. Nancy Pelosi has had a great career, a great run of it.
Yeah.
Some of it's been good, some of it's been bad.
Yeah.
She's also super old. She also doesn't need to be the speaker again. There is nothing that requires that successful Democratic politics would make her have to be the speaker.
Correct.
Like, I also can see, I have seen ways in which she can be quite successful. I mean, Brent and when she was, you know, there was that era where she was, when we were in the minority, where she could deliver a fucking vote on anything.
Totally.
And we were like, I don't know if she's like murdering people's grandkids or whatever,
right.
But she will make sure that you vote.
Yeah.
So she's great at leading a caucus in that respect. But she doesn't need to be the speaker forever. She could be the whip. Exactly. Also, this might be the moment where her style of politics is also on the outs.
I have a feeling she is smart enough to sort of see it as her moment as such.
I agree.
I don't think that she would be, and I'm not saying that she would do it in like an angry or an aggressive way or whatever, but I think that she would, if Sanders became the president and the Democrats kept the House, I imagine Nancy Pelosi would be like, this is for another person.
I think so too.
Yeah.
But then my second and more important point is, this Pete suggesting that these down ballot people in purple districts would be better off running with a 38-year-old gay man who's only ever been the mayor of a small city?
Yeah. Yes, he is.
Because that's...
Yes, that is what he is doing.
Than a sitting U.S. senator who's been in office since the dawn of time? Like that...
Yes.
What brain science is he using to come up with these thoughts?
None.
It's like
none.
There was like some tweet that one of my friends sent me that was about... It was like... I'm sorry, I like invented a kind of AI that has like knows 100,000 words and can mimic the cadence of regular human speech. And I'm worried I've lost him. Does anyone have any ideas where he went?
Yeah.
And then Joe Biden, in his speech, just like declared victory. Oh, he'd finally come in second. Right.
Somebody shouted at him, come back, kid, during his speech. It's
like, again, he's pulling it 20%.
Yes.
20%. Yeah. He is 27 points behind
right,
Bernie.
He is, right, yes.
Just FYI.
Getting less than half the amount of delegates that Sanders is.
Meanwhile, we have some new polling in some upcoming states.
Yeah, exciting.
We have some polling from South Carolina that shows Biden's lead has narrowed to 5 points, which, considering that this was supposed to be his firewall, and we said this last week too, is not a great showing.
No, it's not.
Sanders is slowly gaining on him, and Steyer is actually in third there. And
I'll be curious to see how that
I know. I'm so curious. It's Steyer third, Warren fourth, Buttigieg fifth.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
And as much as I don't know how Steyer got 18 there, I am sort of curious what becomes of Buttigieg's campaign when he comes in fifth or something in South Carolina. And also, get ready for his campaign to get nasty. I said that earlier, but like, it's going to be nasty.
Yeah.
Surprise, Amy Klobuchar is leading in Minnesota.
Oh, is where she is right now.
Which is where she is. She's
until she goes to North Dakota tomorrow, which has a hotly contested primary on March 10th. A week after Super Tuesday. So she's got plans. Don't worry about her.
No, she's regrouping right now. Right. In Minnesota. She went home to regroup.
She's about to unleash herself on the people of North Dakota.
Where I'm sure they'll be excited to see a candidate.
I'm sure.
You know? Why not? But in Michigan, a state that counts, Sanders is now up by 9. In Wisconsin, he's up by 17. In Pennsylvania, he's up by 5.
Yep.
In the general, according to a new CBS YouGov poll, the national polling average, in national polling, Sanders is up by 9.
Yep.
Guys, he's really having a moment right now.
To Warren in second place, by the way, in that
poll. Yeah, that's right. No, I think that there will be some momentum on Super Tuesday.
That was probably the first poll post
the debate. Yeah.
Is my guess, because it just came out today.
And I think, you know, I don't know if she'll do that great in South Carolina. And I don't expect her to. But I think Super Tuesday has some states where she could expect to maybe have a showing.
She's going
to
do well enough where she will probably at least collect some delegates and probably claim that she did okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Here being one of them, probably.
Yes. No, totally. I think
she's been in and out of second place here in California for quite a long time. I mean, winning when she was winning everywhere. But she's still does well here in most polling. We can vote here now, by the way, guys, too.
Yeah. The voting centers opened on the 22nd.
Yeah.
And now you can just go vote. And one thing to keep in mind if you are a California voter is if you are registered no party preference, you get a ballot, you didn't request a Democratic ballot, you can still vote in the Democratic primary. You have to go to a polling center and request a Democratic ballot.
Yeah.
But if you're no party preference, if you are registered as an independent, like with a party, an independent party, first of all, calm down. Second of all, you can't vote in the primary, so that sucks for you.
Yeah.
Third of all, if you are registered with the independent party, immediately rethink your life because they are trying to fool you.
Amazing.
But in any case, if you are in California, you can vote early now in a lot of major cities in California. I think the Bay Area cities and San Diego also have early voting now. So a lot of Californians can cast their ballot. I would say if you can, if you know you'll definitely vote regardless. Yeah. Wait until after South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, think of all of the people who may have wished that they had caucused for Liz Warren.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't know how many people those are, but the numbers don't bear out that it might have been that many people.
Exactly.
But we don't know.
We don't know anything.
And that always happens. I mean, you've had to send in a vote. You early voted or sent
in a
vote.
Yeah, I early voted once and then my candidate dropped out.
I don't know that that is necessarily going to happen here, but like, I just think it's always like best to be armed with the information that you can be armed with.
Exactly.
And look, you can still early vote even if you wait a week.
Yeah, I'm going to early vote the weekend before.
Our primary is not until March 3rd, and the South Carolina is next Saturday. So you've still got 3 days to early vote if you want. If you're really itching to get out there the day before for whatever reason, you can still wait until South Carolina does its thing before you decide what you're going to do.
That's right. But do vote, and if you need our voter guide, we have it. So, you know. Send us an email and we'll add you to the list. We already sent it out, but we're going to send it out again before the election. And we will talk to you guys next week.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.